welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm the editor and webmaster of redicecreations.com, and this is our internet talk radio show recorded from the west coast of Sweden. You can join us every Thursday and Sunday for our regular program, and don't miss out on our subscriber section if you want to have full access to our growing archive of radio interviews. Today we have Tom Horn back with us on the show. Tom was first with us almost exactly a year ago, so this is a very good time to have Tom back. He is, of course, behind the website RaidersNewsNetwork.com. He's the author to The Armon Gate, and he's been a guest on a numerous talk radio shows around the States and also around the web. And today we're going to spend some time talking with Tom about his new and upcoming book, Nephilim Stargates, the year 2012, and The Return of the Watchers. Pretty intriguing title, to say the least. This is going to be fascinating. I'm really excited about today's program. So let's say welcome back to the program, Mr. Horn. It's nice to have you on the show again, and thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Henrik. And you know, I was thinking before we came on the show that it'd been about an hour, so I appreciate, about a year since I had been on, so I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
You know, as you get older, you wonder if you're memory is as accurate as it ought to be. So
yeah, that's right. How about the time speed? As I've been having, you know, the experience, the time, the sense of that the time is going faster and faster, and many people always, you know, attribute that to age, I guess. But have you experienced that, by the way? You know,
look, I can, and when I look in the mirror in the morning, I can see it in the loss of my hair. So I know it's happening.
Yeah,
there's no way to stop it, brother. So we just do, you know, we just got to hang on. By the way, let me give you kudos for your website. One of the things I always appreciate about Red Ice is the artwork and some of the other stuff that you guys do there is just absolutely world class. I love it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that's our angle, I guess, to it a bit. I mean, there's a lot of info out there, as it were, and we try to just, you know, squeeze in the good bits and try to spice that up a lot with the artwork. So thank you for that one. Thank you, Tom. Yeah, I follow along, you know, RaidersNewsNetwork.com. Excellent website, and also appreciate very much, you know, the stories, very similar interests, and you, of course, were one of the first to open up my eyes to this particular topic that we, of course, will be talking about here today, you know, on the Nephilim and the Watchers, and most certainly the technological aspect to it. But just thinking about this, Tom, before we kick things off and dive into talking about your new book, we might have some new people with us who might be unfamiliar with you and your works. Okay. It might be a good idea to maybe if you could tell us a little bit about yourself before that.
Well, just very quickly, my wife and I, Anita and I, we've been involved in a lot of different things over the years. You know, I don't know that I should go back and rehash all of that, but most recently, in the last couple of years, her and I co-authored a book called The Armon Gate. That was a book that that was the first interview that you did with me.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on that book, and you and I got into a lengthy conversation at that time, I think, about genetically modified crops.
Yeah,
and talking about transgenics and things like that. I'm happy to say that in the last year, of course, we've had more time for writing and speaking on things that interest us. And I'm going to be speaking at the Roswell Convention here in the United States here in another few weeks. And I've got to get ready for that. So we're doing all that. The other thing we've started doing is that we're publishing other authors now. You know, we launched a publishing house here in the U.S. about, maybe 2 years ago, but we haven't been pushing it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, you know, we've got Patty Heron wanting us to publish his new book, Apocalypse Soon. We just published Lynn Marzulli's new book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually just signed a contract with George Archibald, the former lead investigator for the Washington Times.
Oh.
And when this top secret book comes out in January, just before the primaries here in the U.S., people are going to know why Archibald was nominated for the Pulitzer 5 times, because I predict that this book's going to significantly affect the national election here in the United States.
Oh, really?
So that's part of what we're doing now that's of great interest. And of course, you know, like you say, every day we've got Raiders News Network. We're always trying to find reputable news stories, things that we believe to be legitimate news stories, but cutting edge, edgy stuff.
Yeah.
And we leave all the other blasé news to all the other news agencies, kind of like red ice. You know, we go for the throat. We look for the stuff that seems to be kind of on the edge and that nobody else might be covering, but that has some credibility.
Definitely.
So now, of course, the most recent foyer of mine into writing is this book, Nephilim Stargates, the year 2012 and the Return of the Watchers, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
This is a book, Henrik, that is actually a hard look at the real science and the real history behind the fiction, behind the novel that my wife and I wrote, The Ahriman Gate.
This book
actually looks at much of the research that we were doing that led to the writing of that novel, and I just felt that this information could not be, it couldn't just be put into a locker, that these were things that needed to be discussed, because these are real advancing sciences, and there's a great deal of history
behind
what some of this science may have done in ancient history and might be doing today.
Definitely. Also, I understand that your interest in this subject dates back to your childhood and a discovery made by your dad, isn't that so?
Yeah, that's a different story altogether. You know, when I was a child, my dad was a police officer, and one day when he was deer hunting, he loved to deer hunt up in the mountains here in Arizona. He came across these large holes in the ground. He'd never seen them before, and you know, Dad was very familiar with the Arizona desert. He had grown up riding fence line for the Bard Ranch, which was the largest open range territory ranch in the state of Arizona at the time, tens of thousands of acres.
Mm-hmm.
Very familiar with all this land. And as a police officer, of course, he was also familiar with this land. He knew all the local native Indians, people living in that area. And he's up hunting in an area he's very familiar with, and he comes around this corner on the part of this mountain, and all of a sudden here are these very large holes in the ground. He had never seen them before.
Hmm.
Now, Henrik, these things were probably 20 feet across and maybe 8 feet deep, and they had essentially appeared overnight.
Okay.
They were filled with rainwater, and the deer were coming down trying to drink the water out of these large holes, and they were slipping off into these holes, and then they couldn't get out, and they were drowning.
Hmm.
And Dad took pictures of these holes, came home, showed me and my family pictures of the holes. I still have copies of these pictures. If anybody wants to see them, they can email me at raidersnewsupdate@gmail.com. I'll be happy to show them copies of these pictures. But so Dad took pictures of these things. He comes back to the police department. He contacts a member of the Army Corps of Engineers. He takes a member of the Army Corps of Engineers up there. They don't know what these holes are, where they came from, or how they were built. They talk to the local native Indians. They're not aware of them being there, which told them that these things had to appear essentially overnight. The Phoenix Gazette, which was the largest, and still is, by the way, the largest newspaper in the state of Arizona and the city of Phoenix, went out and took pictures of my dad kneeling down beside these holes with his hunting rifle. The headline on that story was called Mysterious Mountain Holes. And the bottom line was nobody ever did determine how the holes were made or where they came from. And so finally the Corps of Engineers just dynamited these holes full of rock so that the deer would quit falling into them and drowning.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be the end of the story. But then on November 5, 1975, along the northeastern ridge of that Arizona mountain range, a man by the name of Travis Walton stepped out of his pickup to look at what he called a glowing object. And according to his report, while his crew of loggers were waiting nearby, he approached this UFO or whatever it was and was jolted by a blast of inexplicable energy. And his companions were terrified. They took off in the truck, left him there by himself, and Travis says that he was taken on board this alien spacecraft and subjected to a variety of different kinds of physical examinations. Now, his story, Fire in the Sky, was made into a motion picture, and it reports what's considered to be, at least as far as I know, even today, one of the best documented accounts of a UFO abduction ever recorded. I don't know if Travis Walton's story is true. I don't say whether it was or it wasn't, but I do know that I've talked to Stanton Friedman and other people who know Travis personally. family, and they believe that he's very credible.
Mm-hmm.
They believe the story is also very credible.
Mm.
I also don't know if there was a connection between what happened to Walton and what my dad had discovered in that mountain range not long after. You have to remember about my dad that he had received commendations from the FBI for investigative field work and other things later on down the road. But my dad was connected, to put it in normal terms, he was connected to both sides of the law.
Okay, yeah, so I see.
Dad had guys on one side of the law that would feed him information and so on.
Yeah.
But what I know is, Henrik, that right after he made that discovery, my aunt, who lived just a few doors down from us, was petrified one morning. My mother told me this story years later when I was an adult. She wouldn't tell me this when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
But she had walked down to the house, knocked on the door. My mother said, "You open the door," and here was my aunt that was just white-faced, and she was talking about this dish-shaped object that she had seen hovering above our home, and it scared her.
Mm.
Now, this was a long time ago. This was long before people were talking about flying saucers and any of that kind of stuff. She didn't make any claim that it was a flying saucer. She didn't know what it was.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
These were not even common terms back then. She just simply described what she saw, and years later, I understood that her description would fit with today what we call something that fits ufology.
Yeah.
But it was almost immediately after that my older sister one night woke my entire family up. It was about 2:00 in the morning. Suddenly she is screaming in a way that you never want to hear a human scream.
Mm.
And all of us jumped out of bed and we ran to her room. She was sitting up in bed. Her eyes were just wide like golf balls. She looked like she was in shock.
Yeah.
I didn't know that as a child, but years later, after I had graduated from 2 years of psychology and some other things, I looked back at it, and when I realized that she was in shock.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mother made all of us leave the room. So my dad and both of us boys, we went back to our rooms, and we couldn't sleep. We just sat there all night until the morning. But my mother stayed with her. Well, what I found out years later was that she had woke up in the middle of the night. She could hear whispering in a language that she didn't understand.
Mm.
And something touched her feet and was touching her feet, then touching her legs. And slowly she opened her eyes and was looking in the room, and here are these three bulbous-headed, gray-like creatures that were in the room. And there was light coming from the bathroom so that she could see these things. And it petrified her. She didn't know what to do. She wanted to scream. She was too terrified to scream. She was too afraid to scream.
Mm.
And finally, one of these things was looking at her, and it walked up and it laid its hand on her head.
Hmm.
And when it did, that's when she screamed out loud, and we all ran in there. And by the time we got in there, whatever was there was gone.
Hmm.
And what you have to understand, Henrik, is that I grew up in a very old-fashioned Christian home. This was not something that was part of our. It was not part of our world at all.
Yeah.
It was not something we thought about. For that matter, back then there wasn't really any information like this anyway. But we didn't think about things like apparitions or the paranormal, or we weren't allowed to watch television. We were a very strict family.
Mm.
We weren't allowed to read magazines that might have this bizarre phenomenon in it or whatever.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
And yet this phenomenon occurred. It happened.
Mm.
And it was buried in my family. Nobody talked about it.
Mm.
And my sister went to our pastor at the time. He wasn't able to explain nothing. Later on, she went and seen some other spiritual advisors. Most of them had a very superficial way of looking at this that had to do with just thinking that she was either crazy, or that it might be demonological, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that was not something that my family bought into, and so we simply buried it. But the thing is, it never stopped.
Oh, really?
It continued to happen her whole life, and at times it couldn't be predicted. She wound up marrying a man who worked for Los Alamos, and a man that worked at Los Alamos told her that the experiences were real. Also shared other private information with her that she would never share with anybody. And I'm the person she's the closest to. Mm-hmm. She would never share any of this information with me. Mm-hmm. One day he was just disappeared. He never came home. Mm-hmm. She never found out about it. Years later, in her contacting the U.S. government trying to figure out what happened to her husband. Yeah. Finally, they let her know that he had been killed at Los Alamos. They would not tell her why, but they did let her have his Social Security, which meant that somebody up, since they would not issue a death certificate, somebody way up the line had to approve that at some level in the government for her to be able to draw his Social Security. Years later, her daughter is working, as a federal employee for the Social Security Division, and she started having exactly the same experiences.
Oh man.
And when she went to the head psych doctor at the Social Security Division, they told her not only was it real, but that the government was aware of it. These are facts.
Yeah.
Anyway, then eventually her daughter, so now you had three generations of women, her daughter started having the same experiences. These are all people who do not talk about this phenomenon. They are not interested in publicity. They have talked to me only privately, and aware of the fact that sometimes when I'm on radio, I will share some of these events, but I don't name the people. I don't provide any other kind of information for them because they're not seeking publicity. They're not interested in any of that.
Yeah.
But this is a phenomenon that is real. And the story, I don't want to just get caught up in this one story, but I mean, the story is so deep that even eventually Steven Spielberg identified my niece, the second in this line of lineage, as when he was doing his Taken television series, identified her as one of two people out of the state of Oregon that he concluded was an abductee, and even allowed her to see his private collection of alien implants. So there's a lot to that story, and one of these days I'll write the book and tell the whole story. I'm going to talk a little bit about that probably when I'm at the Roswell convention.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah,
it's what made me start thinking that there is something to this, because growing up in a family like that and burying this activity, not talking about it publicly, but years later, here I am, and, you know, I'm a pastor, for crying out loud, and yet I know that this activity was going on in my family, and as decades went by, I started seeing where other people around the world were giving testimony to an extraordinary event that was touching them. And when I'm reading their stories, I'm realizing that their descriptions and that the sense that they had about what was going on and that their feelings, that these are things that were, if not identical, very comparable to, in almost every case, the ones that were believable, the same thing that my sister had been going through. So it made me feel that there was, in fact, something here that was going on and that it was real.
Yeah.
So if
we say like this, so an explanation for you with concerning this phenomenon, the experiences that your family and so forth have had with this, has fallen to become, you know, known as the Nephilim from the Bible, right? This is connection.
Certainly. Look, when we were writing the book, The Ahriman Gate. And it's very interesting, Henrik, how we got on this. It was about maybe 12 years ago, and at the time I was doing research for some leading newspapers, some large newspapers here in the United States. I was a researcher for several newspapers, and I'm doing research work, and I came across a grant that the U.S. government was giving to a particular company for purposes of research into transgenic science. And I'd never heard this term, transgenics. I didn't even know what it meant. And as I read the meaning of the term transgenics and realized that they were talking about, you know, merging the genetics, the DNA of one species with the DNA of another species, I had an interest in why they would do that. It was fascinating to me. And I found out that that year, fully one-fourth of all federal research grants in the United States were going to transgenics, and I was just blown away by this. I thought, you know, if one-fourth of our tax dollars in the United States, which is the most tax dollars in the world per country, if this is going to transgenic research, and I've never heard of this term, and I'm a researcher, and I know that the general public is way outside of the loop on this, and what is this all about? So I started digging into this and finding anything I could about biotechnology, synthetic biology, genetic engineering, genetic modification, cloning, stem cell science, transgenic science, all of that. And I was stunned that nobody in the faith community was writing about this at all. I mean, I could not find a single book. I couldn't find a single news story. Nobody was talking about what might be some of the ramifications, what might be some of the ethics or philosophical questions raised by what was happening in this emerging science. And so I wrote a couple of editorials. One of these editorials received fairly wide publication, and one of the people that contacted me right after the fact was Cal Thomas, the syndicated columnist for the LA Times and the co-host at that time of CNN's Crossfire.
Okay.
And he wanted to share with me his opinion that what I had written was evidence, at least in his world view, that the world was winding down, that we had entered this quickening of events that foreshadowed end of the world prophecies from all these different religions. I mean, he just believed that what I was talking about pointed to that. Now, after I received his response, there were others that were followed, and soon it started becoming evident to me that most of the common people were woefully unaware of a new dawn of science and technology that was ultimately going to open the door to the prospects on the positive side, the prospects for the cure of various kinds of debilitating diseases, which could be a good thing, but on the other side, the prospects of a transhumanist future, as well as maybe even potentially a biological Pandora's box, a biological nightmare.
Yeah, indeed.
Which you and I talked about a year ago, the what we're seeing already in genetically modified crops.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. I mean, so
I had started compiling all of this research material. I was up to thousands of pages, and anything I could find, as well as making contacts with actual people who were involved in biotechnology, anybody that was willing to talk to me about the subject. Now, but because the first book that I wrote in this field was a novel, the Ahriman Gate, I brought my wife on board because she's a novelist and I'm not, to help me with developing the characters and all that. The book went on to become a bestseller because people are interested in this whole idea that biotechnology might actually be used to resurrect dead Nephilim or, some other kind of a nightmare scenario as we had outlined in that book.
Yeah.
But it was the real science and the real history that stuck out to me as the most thrilling.
That's right. Yeah.
Because it almost seemed to me when we were doing the research for this book, in order to make the novel believable, we wanted the science to be such that if a person reading the novel read in the book about cloning or transgenics, it would sound believable to somebody who might know something about science. So we were doing all of this research.
Yeah.
But while we were doing that, this odd thing happened, Hendrik, in that we're trying to find stories about the cross-blending of species. And what we kept running into was this telling in ancient history of an event. Because these were the real records that were out there, and they were everywhere. In every mythos of every great culture around the world, a story of the gods who came down and they tinkered with genetic material, DNA, of humans and other living species. And it started feeling like we were actually retracing the first records in history of actual transgenic science, which had been conducted by these super intelligences who, for their own reasons, were the first to open the Ahriman Gate. And I started wondering, you know, is man today rushing into sciences that had been first introduced on Earth thousands of years ago that led to chaos? And astonishingly, that seemed to be the record. All these different civilizations.
Why do you think, if we were to put it like this, is this, as you say, a return in the sense that there's something coming from the outside in, or this is something that is happening, you know, on the planet, a development of these creatures? That is what you're saying, right?
You know what? I think it could actually be both. I think it could actually be both. If things existed once before, and there was some method by which the incarnated expressions, let's call them the Nephilim, were destroyed. But there are texts, and we can talk about those texts. I don't know if we'll run out of time today, but if we do, I can come back at some point and we can talk about those texts. There are ancient records that tell us that the spirits of these destroyed supernaturals exist in another dimension and can be resurrected back into our three-dimensional reality. And in the same way that it happened the first time. Okay, so you have this story, whether it's the Bible or other ancient text, records from Greek mythology, Assyrian mythology, Egyptian mythology, you have this story.
That's right.
Of these gods who came down. And what was it that they did? They mingled their species with the human race.
That's right.
But note that it was the methodology. What appeared to be a record of advanced science, for the life of me, what looks like modern biotechnology, where in all of these different mythologies, these gods, in order to materialize or to take three-dimensional expression, for some reason it seemed to require the need to blend these different species in order to create some pathway, some portal through which they could extend themselves into our material world. For instance, such ancient texts as the Book of Jasher, which is an extra-biblical book, but it's referred to in the Bible in the Book of Joshua 10:13, and also in 2 Samuel 1:18. And this Jasher says this in Jasher 4:18. It says, "And the fallen angels went in to the daughters of men." Or it says, "After the fallen angels went in to the daughters of men, the sons of men taught the mixture of animals of one species with the other in order to provoke the Lord," end quote. Now, that's obviously a direct reference to the Genesis 6 Accord and also to some other outside of the Bible books like the Genesis Apocryphon and the Book of Enoch and so on.
Indeed.
That are a record of some kind of event. But the interesting thing to me in this Book of Jasher, and there were many other texts that I found, was that it included the part of the history of this event was that as soon as this event happened, suddenly the sons of men began teaching the mixture of one species with another species. Now, I also noted as I was doing this research, which led me to ufology, which we also included in that book, The Ahriman Gate, and we do also include that in this new book. I also noted, though, that in abduction records, in many abduction records, there is this account of the harvesting of human DNA, of ovum, of other kinds of material that guys like John Keel and Jacques Vallée and other secular researchers into this field found that whoever these ultra-terrestrials are, that they seem to need to collect for themselves what Jacques Vallée called vital energy.
Interesting.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Molecular matter that's associated with three-dimensional life forms.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? Vallée and others have assumed that this is some kind of a construct material,
mm-hmm.
some matter that they need for achieving incarnation into our reality.
Ah, I see, yeah. So this
now,
is...
Mm-hmm. And of course, that would, you know, for people of faith, that would go along with the biblical record. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that the blah, 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 and they took for themselves wives, and that they saw that they were fit, in the Septuagint version it says, they saw that they were fit extensions.
Hmm.
They were a material form through which they could extend themselves from their dimension into ours.
So this is interesting because this is not the way that people, you know, conventionally in that sense you think of it. Because if what you're saying here, I guess, is that through the means of transgenic science, you can actually create a creature, and into that creature, a spirit or an entity is incarnated, right?
That's absolutely right. Now, what some people have said is that if you take a very orthodox approach to this, you would say that God created... Now, God... I'm a Christian, so God to me is one thing. It might mean something to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that when we're talking about this, that anybody from any different persuasion can listen to this and understand the logic behind it and not get bogged down in the fact that I'm a Christian. I just want to appeal to everybody here.
That's right, yeah.
So God creates. And in the Hebrew Bible, it says, you know, he breathes into the nostrils of his creation.
Mm.
And they become a living soul. And it says that he looks at it and he says, it is ta'ud, that's the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
It is very good, meaning it's exactly what I wanted it to be, but it means more than that. It means this is something into which my spirit can dwell.
Mm.
Now we're talking about a creation into which a spiritual reality can exist comfortably.
Mm.
It can be there. The New Testament, know ye not, you are temples of the Holy Spirit.
Mm.
But now, in order to maybe make something entirely different, into which a different kind of a spirit can dwell, it is necessary to corrupt that creation, to make it entirely something different, into which these other angels, which according to the book of Enoch, these watchers, these powerful angels who came down, left their first estate, came down, saw the daughters of men and incarnate, they need to corrupt or change this creation so that it is no longer something that is suitable for the Spirit of God. Now it is something that is suitable for something entirely different.
Hmm. Tom, do you think that the kind of, if we can say like this, then the recipe for these creatures are, do you think that this is something that was and is developed entirely by humans, and if so, do you think that they actually know what they're doing, or are they receiving instructions for this from somewhere?
No, I think both. Obviously, look, in the military, you have people who need to know, and you have people who don't need to know.
That's right, yeah.
You understand?
Yeah, definitely.
And I do think that there are people who are in powerful positions, both government and military, who are fully aware of what they are doing, and I think there are others who are not aware, they just follow orders.
Let me say before I leave this point to
people of faith out there, because I've ran into this many times, Henrik, where this bothers people of faith, the idea that creation could be made by these ultra-terrestrials, because I've ran into this so many times where they say there's only one creator, only God can create, nobody else can create.
Mm.
And I like to make this point that it is, that theologically, it is correct to say that the original creator is the only one who possesses the power to speak. And now in the Hebrew, this is the word haya, or let there be.
Mm.
He's the only one who can speak and call raw atomic or nuclear energy out of nothingness into specified molecular form. However, once that's been done, that created living energy can be altered by any kind of superintelligence. intelligence, or even human intelligence.
That's
we're doing it right now.
That's right.
In the United States and Australia and the United Kingdom, all over the world right now, we're blending humans with animals and creating chimeric embryos.
That's right, yeah.
So once it's made, that created living energy after the fact can be manipulated by intelligence. And what the case that Vali and others made was that this might be in order to construct some three-dimensional expression for themselves. Now, it might also explain why animals and humans have been killed and mutilated and even stolen away in these UFO flap areas.
That's right, yeah.
Because this material is being harvested for reasons that are beyond our comprehension. It might also explain why all of these ancients who wrote these first records, these original records, the Sumerians, the Hebrews, the Hittites, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, it might explain why they were terrified of these creatures, called them gods, fell down in subservience, and believed that. And this goes to why I named the book Nephilim Stargates, because they believed that gateways on Earth were symbolic of other dimensional or celestial openings through which dark influences or light influences might seek entry. And therefore, it was important in all of these different ancient religions to use imitative magic for protection against the undesirable entities in their homes and in their cities and so on. And that's the reason why even today you'll see people who are very orthodox in their faith lighting candles and putting them in their windows or doing certain things to the archways and doorways to their homes to bless those openings. And this goes back to a very ancient idea that archways, openings, portals, stargates, represented pathways through which something could come. Some of that comes through those gateways might be good, but some of it might not be. And we want to block that we don't want to come through. And so you have these gateways, or stargates as I refer to them, represented on Earth, for instance, in Assyrian archways, where, for instance, they use these elaborate construction ceremonies. And then they blessed these archways and openings into their cities and into their homes by the names of good omens and by the names of good gods. And in the major, like the palaces and in the city entryways, they'd build these colossal transgenic creatures. Have you ever looked at some of the Assyrian archways going into their cities? You see these giant transgenic creatures that flank the city gates on both sides.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And they would even bury underneath, as you walked through the opening, they would bury underneath the opening these other kinds of magical devices, protective statuettes and stuff that was supposed to keep anything evil from coming through those openings. Anyway, so there is this idea, and it's a concept, Henrik, that is so astonishing that hidden or unseen intelligence that it can sometimes, and for reasons that we may not understand, reach through from another world and touch us. And that's something that intersects with our humanity on so many different levels, including spiritually, obviously.
Yeah, indeed.
But in the case of the Nephilim and the Watchers and these original stories, if you look at the Book of Enoch, the Genesis Apocryphon, also the Old Testament, Jasher and others, you find this record that appears to have included the need for both animals and humans to have been cross-blended in order for them to incarnate themselves. Enoch says in the 7th chapter of the Book of Enoch, he says, and they sinned against the animals as well as the humans. And you have to ask if the only reason that the Watchers were involving themselves with women was because they lusted after their physical beauty, then what in the world was all this blending animal DNA and human DNA all about? And I tell people, you know, you have to admit that even if the ancient stories of lore are nothing more than fiction or myth, the metaphorical resemblance to parts of what are happening in science today, and transhumanism is astonishing. Even the secular press, taken to use in terms like chimera from Greek mythology.
That's right, yeah, that's right.
To describe these hybrid creations that we're making. But chimera in mythology also foreshadowed natural disaster. And that might be a metaphor, too.
Huh.
That transgenically blending species of living organisms, people, food, animals, that we could be doing something that this ancient record is warning us about, that it led to chaos, it led to judgment, it led to destruction. There might be a reason why the only records we have of humanity appear only a few thousand years ago, because humanity may have obliterated itself in its willingness to cross these species boundaries, and we're already seeing with genetically modified crops that this does things we are not prepared for whatsoever.
Yeah,
but in any case, interesting discovery, Henrik, to me, to start out studying, to write a novel and study modern biotechnology and transgenics in order to be accurate, that I made this discovery.
Mm.
And if you include ufology and alien abduction, that perhaps something has been going on nonstop throughout history, a record of super intelligent unknowns who blend species, and in some of those records, the purpose behind it was so that they might incarnate themselves in our reality.
Hmm. Do you think that, let me ask you this, do you think that the, let's say that some of the, on the higher ups that are human, let's say, for to begin with, that they themselves actually are studying the Bible or studying ancient texts to actually get more, you know, knowledge of what they are trying to achieve, to try to recreate this mythology again? Do you think there is an awareness of this higher up there?
You mean like in the government, the military?
For instance, yes.
Well, certainly I do. I think that they understand that behind the myth there is real science, real technology, and real history. And that there could be things like, let's say, you know, our reason for invading Iraq.
Yeah, that's right.
Hasn't made any sense to anybody anywhere.
Yeah,
unless
that's right.
It was some of the reason which we have not yet explained for why we went there.
Yeah, but going back again to that very ancient country to be in that area maybe for some reason, or to you know, look for certain artifacts or something like that. That's the suggestion you're making here, right?
Well, I am, and one of these days let's do an entire show on that. By the way, I'm working on a brand new book. This is the most top secret project I've ever worked on. I'm leaving Oregon in 2 weeks for a six week road trip in which I'm going to be meeting with some of the lead investigators from several different fields to acquire information that I need, and so I'll answer that question maybe more definitively next year.
But, that sounds good. Yeah.
Sometimes it seems to me, Henrik, that things are happening now in staged events, including what's happening in biotechnology. But also what's happening even in the increase in eyewitness accounts of ufology and other things.
Yeah.
And that sometimes, it doesn't it feel as if this is happening in staged events that are occurring as we, as a species, can accept or absorb the ramifications?
Definitely.
For instance, from my history, for the bulk of Christians 50 years ago, I can tell you that the idea of alien contact was absurd. But then came Eric von Daniken with his Chariots of the God, and Zachariah Sitchin with his Earth Chronicles series. And what at first felt like a challenge to orthodoxy caused scholars on both, you know, on all sides of the aisle, the religious, the secular, to begin, and the government, to begin asking the question, what are UFOs. Now, if they are something besides figments of the imagination, people misinterpreting, you know, seeing Venus in the night sky and thinking that they're seeing something, or even top secret military aircraft under design that have not yet been made public.
Yeah, that's right.
If ufology is something besides that, if there is something to it that is almost borderline supernatural that we cannot put our fingers on, and yet it's real and it happens, what would the effect be on religion if we were suddenly faced with the reality that we are not the sole higher intelligence in the universe? And this was the question that was raised by some of these guys like Sitchin and von Daniken. In communities of orthodoxy who had never taken the time to ask the question, what are UFOs, what are aliens, what, you know, what is some of this paranormal phenomenon? But all of a sudden what was happening back in the 60s was that, you know, people were reading these books. In the 60s, von Daniken's book, Chariot of the Gods, became an international bestseller.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And it caused many of the professors in their Bible colleges, students were coming to them saying, well, what is this?
Yeah.
What is this about?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden they had to answer questions they'd never had to answer before.
Yeah, that's right.
And it caused them to have to take a hard look at the phenomenon and to decide for themselves what it was.
Yeah.
Many of them, at least in the more conservative field, fell into these, I think, overly simplistic interpretations of angelology and demonology, but there were others who said, okay, maybe part of it could be comparable to angelology, maybe part of it could be compared to demonology, but there is this other something.
Yeah, yeah.
And what, you know, and so you've got a few guys out there like Mike Heiser and some others who have been bold enough and willing enough to say there could be something entirely different here.
Yeah.
That is occurring and that we have not put our fingers on. Now, Dr. I.D.E. Thomas, early on in the, I think in the 70s, you know, he was one of the first Bible college presidents, and he wrote the book The Cosmic Conspiracy. Are you familiar with that book?
Yeah, I've heard the title. I've never read it, but no.
Yeah. And I've sat down with, you know, Dr. Thomas is a Quintarian now. He's 80-some years old. He lives down in California. I've sat down and had lunch with him.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to republish his book. It's went out of print because his publisher went bankrupt.
Oh,
but I've sat down with him, and he said, you know, I had all these students coming to me asking me what this is, and I didn't have no answers, and there wasn't anything written about it, so I had to do the work. And so he wrote this book, and it's for 30 years it's been his best-selling book.
Yeah.
But now, more recently, you have Vatican astronomers like Guy Cosmonaugo last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Releasing this whole series of publications dealing with the possibility of extraterrestrials or multidimensional intelligence. And he doesn't just hint. He comes out and says in his Intelligent Life in the Universe, Catholic Belief and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life, which was published by a publisher owned by the Vatican, he comes out and says that we are now facing a greater than not possibility of extraterrestrial contact with intelligence.
Oh my.
He's not talking about microbiological life forms. He's talking about intelligence that can communicate with us.
Yeah, indeed.
I was on Coast to Coast a couple of weeks ago, and usually I'm on with George Norrie, but this time I was on with Art Bell.
Yeah.
And I said to Art Bell, I said, do you find it interesting, given what you asked Malachi Martin on your show in 1997? And remember, Father Malachi, he placed a time frame of about 10 years on his feelings that what was or is approaching the Earth was going to be of great importance within 5 to 10 years. Now think about this. This was 1997, and Art Bell on Coast to Coast asked Malachi Martin why the Vatican was heavily invested in the study of deep space at Mount Graham Observatory in southeastern Arizona. And Martin He was a retired professor of the Pontifical Biblical Institute. He was uniquely qualified to hold in secret information pertaining to the Vatican's Advanced Technology Telescope Project at Mount Graham International Observatory.
Mm.
And his answer ignited a firestorm among ufologists, because when Art Bell said, "Why is the Vatican so heavily invested in the study of deep space?" Father Martin said, "Because the mentality of those at the highest levels of Vatican administration and geopolitics know what is going on in space and what is approaching us, and that it could be of the greatest importance
in
the next 5 to 10 years." And those cryptic words, "what's approaching us," could be of the greatest importance in the next 5 to 10 years, was followed in these subsequent interviews with discussions of this mysterious sign in the sky that Father Malachi said was approaching the earth from the north. Now, Martin was not a crackpot. He was an eminent Catholic theologian, recognized by the New York Times and everybody who did his books as one of the leading thinkers at that time. But he was also a maverick. He was willing to talk about things that I'm sure the Vatican wished he would have shut up about.
Yeah. So this is interesting, because this is one thing that I did want to get you to today, with the in regards to the connection, of course, obviously with the year 2012 and all of this. And let's say if we were to take Malachius Martin, let's say 10 years from 97, we end up around 2007, sorry, I'm totally missing the idea here, but this, of course, leading up, now we go from 2007, we have 5 years up to 2012. Do you see this increase, as you say, in this kind of information, and what do you think about the year 2012 with all of this?
Well, the point that I was making about Father Malachi Martin is he said this could be of the greatest importance within 5 to 10 years. Well, if you had 10 years to 1997, you wind up at 2007.
Yeah, that's right.
This year.
Yeah, that's right.
And is it any coincidence that this year, the 10-year anniversary of the end of Malachi's time frame, that the Vatican, for the first time, is discussing now shutting down that? And is it because that they learned everything they needed to know? I don't know, but it seems ironic to me that 10 years almost to the day, now we're discovering second Earths.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
Vatican astronomers are publishing these treatises, letting the faithful know that if ET contact occurs, it's not going to be a challenge to their faith or to the authority of Rome. And something I think that the good Father Malachi Martin would have also found extraordinary is now this science for cross-blending species, not only reminiscent of what the Watchers did with the Nephilim, and maybe also comparable to what other dimensional beings that we call aliens have been doing for reasons unknown, that we're at the, we have emerging before us right now the technology to open portals of perception that before now were unknown except to the gods of mythology, such as Quetzalcoatl and Mayan mythology. And now, the year 2012, it's interesting, because among the legends of these multidimensional beings, there was this method that existed whereby, at least at times, they could move from behind their gateways through statues, persons, flying winged discs along heavenly sky locations into Earth's reality. And this even goes into Hermetic iconography, where you have the beginning and ending points of the sky that are positioned where the ecliptic, the pathway of the sun, crosses the Milky Way. Now, ancient descriptions depict the distance between those points as a snake called the Ouroboros, or the tail devourer, encompassing the heavens and swallowing its tail.
That's
one of the oldest mystical symbols in the world. You can find it in Aztec, Chinese, Native American mythologies, other mythologies.
That's right.
In alchemical symbolism, the mouth of the snake is viewed as a place of arrival and departure, spirit beings, gods, angels, higher self, who use this wormhole or stargate to navigate dimensions of heaven. For example, this god Quetzalcoatl, and now this is the most well-known deity of the Aztecs and Mayans, also called Kukulkan, who is portrayed as either being or entering the Ouroboros on these Aztec and Toltec ruins. Now, there's also some renderings of Quetzalcoatl where a ladder is seen descending from the ecliptic.
Yeah, that's right.
Such as when Quetzalcoatl descends from the sky on a rope ladder.
Yeah.
As he's also prophesied to do in the year 2012.
That's right.
The so-called end of times, or at least the end of that time.
Yeah.
The reopening of the serpent portal, the end of the great cycle of the Maya calendar and the planetary cycle of the Aztec calendar, December 21, 2012.
Yeah.
Now, isn't it interesting that you have these other influences? For instance, the Bible, according to the book The Bible Code, the world is going to end on December 21, 2012 due to a collision with a meteor or an asteroid or a comet. You have another theory called the novelty theory that claims that time itself is a fractal wave, which is going to end abruptly in 2012.
The Terence McKenna.
I have a different theory. They describe these past visits of Quetzalcoatl, feathered serpent. Also, another thing, by the way, that's interesting, and I cover a little bit of this in the book Nephilim Stargates, is that according to some, the feathered equates to flying technology.
That's right.
While serpent refers to the heavenly wormhole stargate. Flying technology and stargate technology.
That's right. Interesting. Yeah, that's the connection here that going back to the ancient mythologies, and especially I guess the Maya, but as you say, there's so many things almost on a converging point at that time, it seems like. And even as you say, that there are certain types of technologies like the huge particle accelerators are going in, I think, this year, like ALICE and ATLAS are being implemented, super colliders, particle accelerators, and that also potentially might be a connection, I guess, to all of this that you're talking about, and leading up again to the year 2012. There aren't so many years left, and who knows what's going to happen down the road here.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're searching for the God particle.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
They might find it. And maybe the Mayans are telling them they're going to find it, because their prophecy is that in 2012, this serpent rope is going to emerge again from the center of the Milky Way, and Quetzalcoatl is going to return to mark the end of one age and the beginning of another age.
Do you think that
now there's a part in my book, and it's a guest chapter actually by David Flynn. But he ties the year 2012 and the return of Quetzalcoatl with the Roswell 1947 event. And I won't give up that chapter for a couple of reasons. One, because I'm not smart enough to explain what Dave Flynn explains.
Yeah, I've seen David Flynn's lecture on that, and it's totally brilliant,
Yeah. He wrote that for Raiders News Network. We published it. And then there were several magazines, like UFO Magazine and several others, that asked if they could republish it, and we let them in. But there's a revised version of it that's in our new book.
Fascinating. Tom, I know that you're a bit short for time today, and I know that we've been on here for about an hour now, so I know that you have to run. But before we do that, tell people when your book will be out, how people can get it, and also mention your website again so people can visit there.
Okay, the website is RaidersNewsNetwork.com. Raiders is just like the football team, R-A-I-D-E-R-S, RaidersNewsNetwork.com. We're doing a special thing that some of your readers might find interesting. We're giving away. I'm not there right now to look at the internet to see what it is, but I think we're giving away about $80 worth of free books and other material if people buy that book, Nephilim Stargates, at Amazon.com on July 10. And Amazon is going to be carrying it for $10.17. So this is a terrific deal. Mm. If people want to buy that book, then we're going to send them, I think it's either $70 or $80 worth of free stuff, but they have to buy it on that one day only.
Mm. Okay.
Otherwise, the book it can be pre-ordered now and will be shipped on July 7th.
Mm.
It can be pre-ordered from SurvivorMall.com or RaidersNewsNetwork.com. It can also be pre-ordered, of course, at Amazon.com. But it won't be able to ship until July 7th. And
Okay. We're
hoping that we're going to have some pre-pub copies of it while we're at Roswell. And if people want to attend the Roswell event, I'm going to be giving a 1.5-hour lecture at Roswell along these same lines, but I'm going to be focusing more on the technological aspects and the idea that science could be being used even at this current hour to revive the leftover remains of DNA or potentially Nephilim.
Mm, fascinating. Yeah, again, so that's the 10th of July to order from Amazon, correct?
They can order it on the 10th. If they order it on that one day, they can order it any time they want.
Sure.
But if they order it on the 10th of July, they'll receive... it's either $70 or $80 worth of free product.
Again, Tom, there's a bunch of stuff that we didn't get to, and would love to do a follow-up part two of this sometime if you have time for us down the road here.
Well, certainly any time for you, Henrik, and you just contact me when you want to do it. And I'm going to be leaving here in just a few days on a six-week tour, and I won't be back. And so sometime after, you know, like the end of July or whatever, I'll be back.
That sounds very good. Again, thank you so much for coming on, Tom, and we'll talk soon, okay?
Thank you, Henrik. Keep up the good work.
You too. Thank you so much, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Welcome. This is Red Eyes Radio.